this is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, broadcast out of Guelph, Ontario, on CFRU 93.3 FM. Today, we'll be listening to the second part of the interview I did with Jackson Landers, the locavore hunter. In this part of our interview, Jackson talks about the dangers of hunting nutria in Louisiana, talks about the different weapons that he uses for hunting, how the landscape of the food movement has changed to become more accepting of locavore hunting, and he will also discuss a book that he has recently published that is now available for order online that deals with several aspects of deer hunting. As far as your own experience, have you ever had any dangerous situations you've encountered in hunting?
I've had a few. Working on this, I'm working on my second book, which is called Eating Aliens. It's about dealing with invasive, ecologically disruptive wildlife by hunting it and eating it. And I've been traveling all over North America and the Caribbean, and I've got to have it the first draft handed in by the end of August, actually. That book won't be out until next year. So I've been traveling a lot for that and just finding myself in strange places, hunting strange things. And, yeah, I have been in a few hairy situations. I guess the most recent was, I was hunting nutria in Louisiana. And I hunted all over in different parts of Louisiana.
And sorry, Jax, just before you continue, nutria, like most people.
That's right.
Could you describe it? Yeah, please.
Nutria are a, I'm not fluent in Spanish. My understanding is that it's Spanish for otter, and that the conquistadors arriving in South America many hundreds of years ago saw these big rodents, and they thought the closest word for them they had was otter, and nutria stuck as the Western term for these things, but it is the world's, I believe, third largest rodent. They're a little smaller than beavers. It's like if you know what a capybara looks like. These guys look like scaled down capybaras. It's sort of like a beaver with a somewhat slightly differently shaped head and a round tail as opposed to a flat tail. And they were brought into North America and to many other places, actually in Europe and in parts of Canada. They were brought to North America in starting in the late 1800s and then early 1900s for the fur trade. They were much more practical for farming for fur than beaver and some other species are because they breed so quickly. I mean, this is an animal, I mean, they can get to up to 20 pounds. That's not uncommon at all. And they can be ready to, at the age of 3 months, a lot of the females will go into heat and get pregnant with their first litter. The day after giving birth, they can get pregnant again. So this phenomenal rate of reproduction, not unlike rats. The fur trade collapsed, and these animals were let go all over the place. They are semi-aquatic rodents. They do have webbed hind feet, and they are a big ecological problem. They will burrow into banks. They will dig these big tunnels into which will gradually causes river and stream banks to collapse. They will compete with native beavers, and they will displace them often. They will go in and they will take over a beaver lodge, you know, when they need a place to live and they've been forced out of some place. They will go and they will kill the beavers and they'll take it over. They will eat massive amounts of vegetation and just to eat the stem. So they'll kill a plant in order to eat, you know, 5% of it. There are places in Louisiana where you go out into the marsh and that's pretty much, those guys and the alligators are all that you'll see. So they are a real ecological problem and, they don't taste bad, actually. They taste a lot. Again, they taste like chicken and the texture is like chicken as well. So I found myself in Louisiana. I went down there to hunt nutria and I was there for, I think, about 10 days. I was there for a long time and just in different parts of Louisiana hunting them. And I actually had a reporter and a photographer from Men's Journal magazine tagging along. They were doing an article about me. And the hunt got kind of rough towards the end. It got to the point where, I mean, these animals are, they're mostly nocturnal, actually. So we're having to hunt these animals that are aquatic. So we've got to go to the water. So we're out in these swamps, and they're mostly nocturnal. So we're hunting all night. And we'd been, you know, for the last week or so, we'd been getting no more than like 3 hours of sleep, you know, in any 24-hour period. And we're all mosquito-bitten and sunburnt and just exhausted. And as far as I'm concerned, this is just, you know, this is what I do for a living. Right. These poor guys who were, you know, had been assigned to tag along behind me, we're just having a real rough time of it. Towards the end of the trip, we were hunting outside Baton Rouge and around Port Vincent. is the name of the little town or township, you know, just rural area, really. It's not much of a town, even. Right. Nice area, though. And the alligators were a lot thicker there than they had been up around. We'd been hunting in Shreveport until then. And on the last night, we were trying to get a nutria, which I did finally get one after they left. We were trying to get a nutria to eat, and so we had to go into this out into the swamp along a riverbank and to set a trap. And I'd never done any trapping before aside from, like, you know, mice and rats. And so I had this trap that I had just been shown how to set. It's got a combined force of 500 pounds actual pressure. So if I screwed this up, I knew that I'd lose my hand pretty much. I had no cell phone reception out there. I had to go, about a third of a mile. I had to go out from the road into the swamp where we were seeing the alligators were right there. And I don't want to overstate the danger of alligators because people live around them for years. In Florida, they walk around ponds and they don't get attacked. But hunting around them is a little bit more of a danger because, by definition, we're sitting on the riverbank, right there on the bank, within lunge distance of the alligators,
right,
in the dark. And if you succeed in getting a nutria, you've got an animal that's bleeding and dying right there in the water and thrashing around. And by definition, it's attracting the alligators. And then when you go in to get the nutria, you know, you're kind of contesting the point with, you know, a very large thing that's happy to kill you. So when you're hunting nutria in alligator-infested waters, especially if you don't have a boat, which I didn't, you know, you're in a lot more danger maybe than someone who just is walking their dog around the pond full of alligators.
Right.
So I had to go out into this swamp. It's dark. There are cottonmouths everywhere. We're seeing snakes all over the place. And I said, okay, well, you guys, we got to go in. We got to get this nutria. I've got this really heavy iron trap to carry. I've got that, and I've got a rifle, and then a big spotlight. And I said, okay, so it's going to be teamwork. So I handed my backpack to the one guy. I said, okay, you carry the backpack with all the supplies, and I gave it to the other guy, the photographer. Said, you know, you carry the spotlight, and so you're going to be on. I'm going to walk point. I'm going to carry the trap and the rifle. If anyone sees the nutria, tell me, and I'll shoot it. And photographer, you're on gator duty. You're sweeping the water. If you see a big alligator right near us or something moving towards us, let us know so we can move back from the bank.
Yeah. Are you wearing those headlamps as well too? Because it's at night, or
I did have that. Well, actually, I started out with headlamps, but the problem with a headlamp at night, they're real thick mosquitoes, and if you have the headlamp on your head, you're attracting them to your face.
Right.
So that doesn't work for very long, actually.
Yeah.
So we're thinking this is a dangerous situation. The three of us going out there. I'm saying, and one of the guys, he said, well, wait a second, what about, I said, I'm not wearing real high boots, what about snakes? I said, hey, listen, neither am I. My boots were already soaked, I'd had to change into something. I said, you know, if we get bit by a cottonmouth, you're not going to die. It's going to hurt a lot, but there's three of us. We'll get the guy evacuated to the road, we'll get an ambulance, you go to the hospital, you spend a few days there, you get some swelling for a month, and you'll have a whole story to tell, but you know, you're not going to die because you'll get medical attention. I said, well, yeah, but what about the alligator? I said, well, that's why we're going to have one person on alligator patrol while I'm, you know, it's going to, and I've got a gun. We're going to be okay. And I said, all right, so here we go. So I start walking into the woods. They turn around, and they're still standing there on the road. They wouldn't follow me out. They wouldn't do it. So I had to go out into the, it's almost like jungle, along this river by myself, and I'm sitting there crouched next to a nutria hole right on the bank, which if I'm hunting nutria there, the gators are too. And I actually got some video of this, although it looks like something out of the Blair Witch Project.
Okay.
I'm sitting there with this 6-foot alligator right there on one side of me. I've got this trap in my hands. I'm trying to keep an eye on the alligator while I'm trying to set this trap, and I realize if I screw this trap up and I get my arm stuck in it, they can't hear me calling for help. I've got no cell phone service. There's no way these guys are going to come in to look for me. I've got a cottonmouth, poisonous, you know, also called water moccasins, coming over to check me out. So I've got snakes, alligators, massive trap, and you know, it became a very dangerous situation. At which, you know, people do trapping and that sort of thing all the time. Usually, they've got maybe a little bit more of a support structure there. And I realized if anything went wrong, if I got bit by a snake, if anything like that happened, I was pretty much just going to die out there.
Right.
And so I would say that was probably the stickiest situation I've been in a long time that I've run into.
Mm-hmm.
I think if other people are going to hunt nutria, they don't have to do it. It doesn't have to be that dangerous. The smart money would get an airboat and go out in there in the daytime and
right,
kind of stir them up, but I didn't have an airboat.
Yeah, that is an amazing story. I'm laughing about it, but only because...
It's funny in retrospect. At the time, it was terrifying.
It's absolutely horrifying just to think about. Now, as far as different animals that you do hunt, do you have different weapons of choice for them, I'm imagining?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, we think of, we think of, like, you know, gun nuts and people do a lot of hunting. Every now and then you'll see something, you know, in a newspaper about some guy and the police showed up at his house for some reason. He had like 30 different guns. I'm like, oh, why would you need this? But it's sort of like, if you talk to somebody, let me put it this way, if you talk to somebody who's been a contractor for many years or a handyman, how many hammers he has, you know, you or I might just, most people might just have one hammer for light tasks. But, you know, I actually do a lot of, I enjoy doing a lot of construction and home maintenance just for fun. I've got a brick hammer for I've got a masonry hammer for doing brickwork. I've got a heavy framing hammer, a light tack hammer, a sledgehammer, a mini sledgehammer, and on and on and on. I've got all kinds of different hammer, a ball peen hammer. And same thing can happen with hunting. You can do everything you need with, you know, a 30-06, a 22, and a 12 gauge. But if you hunt long enough, you come up with more specialized weapons for different things. You know, there are archery seasons, and if you want to get on the bow season for deer, you have to use archery. So you might get a bow for that. You know, you want something really light for things like squirrels, or actually Nutria, a 22 rifle does just fine. I find I actually do a lot of hunting in just backwoods, really long, inaccessible places sometimes where I might have to go through half a mile of thorns and briars to get to, where sometimes I don't want a long gun sticking up, you know, over my shoulder and catching on every little branch and bramble. So I actually do a lot of hunting with handguns. I have a .22 target pistol that I can put on my hip, and it's not going to get hung up on everything, and it's going to be accurate. And I'll use a set of shooting sticks and use it almost like I would a rifle, but it's a lot easier to carry into really, really awkward situations sometimes. I find that a rifle is, for something that's not a moving target. For a moving target, you want a shotgun, but a rifle is the most practical way of thing to hunt with usually. People who hunt with bows are usually trying to make it more challenging, and in fact, I've looked at the data for my home state of Virginia. In a typical year, of all the people who buy bow hunting licenses, only about 30% of them tag a single deer the whole season. And bow hunters tend to be the most dedicated hunters, too. So in terms of practically putting meat on the table when the goal is to feed yourself rather than to make something more of a sporting challenge, a rifle is usually the way to go.
Okay.
I've used spears and knives and all sorts of other things. So.
Right. Now, you talk about being, you know, in the wilderness and off, you know, away from anything that we might consider to be sort of civilization or urbanization. There has to be a spiritual aspect to this as well, I think, for you. Is there not?
Being
with nature and being away, you know, and the whole aspect of you're hunting something, whether it's a regulated game species or just an invasive species.
Yeah, I will say this for sure. Beyond just, and this goes beyond where you are when you do this. Bear in mind that, you know, for years I've been. There's certain years where I would say, when you look at where my family's food came from, I'm providing for, you know, a family of four human beings and, until recently, three dogs. Now it's two. You know, very often I've been what you could call a subsistence hunter. I mean, through this economy, there have been a lot of times when, you know, in the winter where I could either buy heating oil or I could buy food, and I couldn't buy both. And where I needed to kill something, I needed to kill a deer, or I wasn't sure how I was going to feed my kids. There have been winters that were like that. And when you're hunting for food, I mean, really for food, not just when you need it to eat, there aren't many situations in modern life where your future, where your fortunes are completely in the hands of nature. It's the only space in modern life where that comes to mind, where when you're hunting for food, you are completely at the whim of nature. You know, the deer or the turkey or the goose appears or it does not. And that ultimately, I think, yeah, it has to become a very spiritual thing. In everything else we do, we have these ways that we sort of run around nature and defeat it. But no matter, I don't care what your weapon is or what your tactics are, if you're out there hunting for food, you know, it is, there's something that's out of your hands that you just have to hope for. And, you know, you will have experiences that don't really fit into the way we've gotten used to thinking about how the world works.
Right. Absolutely. And I'm just wondering, do you feel that with the media attention, you mentioned Men's Journal and you're on the CBC and interviewing you now. I'm wondering, do you feel like you're on the cusp of something where people are now starting to realize like this is a very important aspect, this primordial aspect of our life that we used to have, and we've sort of lost control through, you know, ag industrialization and factory farming, and now we have the slow food movement and the local food movement, and this is another very integral aspect of it?
Yeah, absolutely. When I look at the situation now versus 3 or 4 years ago, the landscape is very different. I mean, a few years ago, you had sort of the seeds of this, of a shift in public opinion towards a shift in how people feel about hunting. You know, a few years ago, maybe had some people who'd read Michael Pollan and sort of thought it'd be neat to hunt for food, but they weren't really talking about it. There was nothing happening in an organized way. And I've made it my mission for the last few years to make hunting to get hunting to be recognized as the critical component of the local food movement that it is. And I've seen it happen. There are other people doing it. I mean, there are a lot of other people who are blogging and writing about locavore hunting. What I've been doing with invasive species has been branded. New York Times decided that I'm an invasivore, and now it's a movement. And actually, I do have a lot of other people doing that. Yeah, there's a whole groundswell of people doing this. There are a lot of people. If you go to any meeting of slow food people or any kind of local food meetup, if there's more than a dozen people in the room, there's going to be at least a couple people, if you ask them, who would say, yeah, I really want to learn how to hunt for food. It's something that people are really feeling like they've lost and they want to start doing again. But what's missing is opportunities for education. I mean, it's really hard for an adult to pick this up. I mean, until very recently, until the last few years, the only people who hunted or only people who wanted to hunt for food were people who grew up doing it and they learned from an older family member. So there haven't been a lot of introductory level texts, books, to explain to adults how to do this. If you went out and bought a hunting book, it was full of all kinds of jargon. It was, you know, going to be intermediate or advanced stuff. Right. And so the resources haven't been there. So that's why I started teaching this class. That's why I wrote my first book, A Beginner's Guide to Hunting Deer for Food. It's available on Amazon for pre-order now, although it doesn't launch and ship until September. And to go hand in hand with the book, I'm actually producing a teaching guide to accompany the book that I'm going to distribute as a PDF for free. That's intended to help. I want people all over the U.S. and Canada to be able to teach pretty much the same curriculum that I teach for my deer classes. Everybody can't fly to Virginia to take my 2-day class. And I want, you know, 200 other people teaching this class. So I'm producing a teaching guide and distributing it for free. I want people to just start doing this organically all over the place. So the attitude has changed. The desire is out there. People within the local food movement want to hunt for food. It's just a question of putting the resources out there that they can use to learn to do it.
Right. So it's sort of creating, I, for lack of a better term, disciples or people that can go and spread, you know, and actually the technical aspect and the practical aspect of doing it. I find the unfortunate thing, you know, when you look at all these how-to or DIY shows on television, they're so contrived, you know, and everything's perfect.
At some point, it turns into your parents put it together, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah. So
pass the tough stuff.
Yeah. I find that this is really important. Now, you've sort of touched on it, but what do you see as the future for locavore hunting as part of the local food renaissance? I mean, you're doing your part. Is there something that public institutions or society in general could be doing to help move this along at a quicker rate and to make it more prominent than it is right now?
I think we need more educational opportunities. I think that the big thing is opportunities for people to learn, and that can mean state and provincial wildlife agencies, you know, putting together free classes. They have free licensing classes already,
right.
But classes for, you know, opportunities for people to learn how to safely use a weapon. Land access. You know, there are a lot of people. I think there are different parts of the local food movement that could support each other and help make this work. I mean, if you go to any group of people who are doing doing, you know, local agriculture. There are a lot of people who, you know, they may have small-scale farms and they're selling vegetables at the farmer's market, you know, people with 40 acres or less. That are producing local food. A lot of those people who they didn't grow up farming, you know, they came to it, you know, after wanting to participate in local food. A lot of them, you know, they're having all kinds of problems with nuisance and invasive wildlife eating their crops, you know, whether it's a deer or starlings or what have you, and they're not sure what to do about it. Those people usually didn't grow up hunting. I think if they can provide land access to other people in the local food movement that want to hunt, that's a perfect synergy. And I really see a lot of opportunity for that, where these two different groups of people just aren't talking to each other enough. So I think it's land access, it's opportunity to learn. And I think that, you know, in a lot of different towns and cities, I think that beginners need to support each other and start forming groups. And, you know, if you get a meetup group or something of locavore hunters where people can get together and learn together, if somebody's one person's got land access, the other person, you know, maybe somebody else has gotten pretty good at butchering, you know, people can get together and teach and, you know, eat some of each other's wild game and learn what they like or what they don't like. I think they need to support each other. So those are the sort of things that I think need to happen and are happening.
Yeah, I just remember I used to grow produce on contract for the Fairmont Hotel chain, and this is out in Alberta, and I had a real problem with Richardson's ground squirrels, and I eventually had to go out and try and hunt them, and then a family of badgers moved in, and that really took care of the problem, actually.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
So,
one way or another.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, I find, too, that the whole aspect of, as you say, you know, getting together and, you know, processing, like doing the butchering, I mean, that maybe there's an opportunity where people have different types of wild game, and they get together, that the whole aspect of diversity and getting there's more than one invasive species in an era often, I think, too.
Yeah, and this is something that it's very really easy to do as an individual. Even if you just ask around, if anyone who's listening to this radio program, you know, if you have some hunting and butchering skills, you know, ask around. Ask when you're getting ready, you're going to be going hunting soon, and you know you're going to be doing it. Ask around and say, hey, who would like to learn how to butcher a deer or a goose or whatever it is? And you got your list of phone numbers, and so as soon as when you get something dead on the ground, you call that list of numbers or send out that email and say, hey, right now I'm going to wait, you know, 45 minutes before, you don't want to wait too long depending on the temperature because the meat will spoil, and just give people an opportunity to come out and watch and learn and participate in a field dressing and in a butchering. It can be a sort of informal thing, and I've always tried to do that when I bag a deer or a goose or something. I just look for who's around that I can teach right now and give them that experience of butchering, because that's a really hard emotional thing for people to get past. Mm. And when you start hunting, the hardest part usually for them emotionally isn't the act of the kill. It's here's this dead thing I have to turn into food. And once you actually do it, it's not that bad. I've taught hundreds of people, probably I would say hundreds at this point, given hands-on instruction in how to gut, skin, and butcher. And within 5 minutes, everyone's always smiling, actually, because it's not as bad as they thought it was. So if you have a little bit of skill in that direction, find out. It may just be one person, maybe a dozen people. When you have something dead on the ground, turn it into an event and just show people how to do it.
Right. I'm also wondering, because of your diverse experience, what do you have as far as your own favorite locally hunted foods, and what do you find to be the best tasting locally hunted invasive species?
Local to me around here, of course, you know, I'm because I'm writing about local food to hunt, I travel all over the place and eat things that aren't usually local to me, but I need to be able to encourage other people in that area to do it. I would say in terms of what's local right here, you know, deer are, back to deer again, but, you know, deer are native to Virginia. They are not invasive. They are a nuisance species. Their numbers are out of control because we've extirpated the native predators, unfortunately. But venison is just—it's very popular. My kids love it. They prefer it to beef. My wife prefers it to beef. You know, venison is the hot item. You know, we go through about a deer a month as long as we can, you know, keep it in the freezer. Right now, this is from a few hours away from the coast, but I have a friend who just brought in he went fishing and brought back for me a whole bunch of Spanish mackerel, actually, which we've been smoking and gorging ourselves on for the last few days, and that's been popular.
Right.
But in terms of what has staying power, where month after month, year after year, everybody wants to keep eating it, is venison. It's so flexible. You can do almost anything that you would with beef. That's the staple in our household.
Right. Now, as far as your with the advent of social media and just the way that the access to information has, even in the last 5 years, exponentially increased, do you find that you're getting a lot of requests to do speaking engagements outside of Virginia and outside of the United States?
Yeah, I well, not so much outside the United States, but I do, and I'm happy to do them. I think I want to speak to as many people as I can. In just a couple of weeks, I'm going to be speaking at the Conference of the Outdoor Writers Association of America in Utah. I do some kind of event in New York City regularly enough. I speak to local food groups. I would say that happens quite a lot, and I'm always happy to go, you know, anywhere I can go to speak or teach a workshop or anything like that. I'm out there trying to spread the word. Absolutely.
Jackson, I want to thank you very much for the time that you've taken to speak to us on the show today about locavore hunting. I find it really interesting, very fascinating, riveting. Some of the stories, just incredible. What's the URL for your website?
The actual URL is confusing, so I'll give you what points to it. Is actually, if you go to just my name, Jackson Landers, J-A-C-K-S-O-N, like Jackson Pollock or Jackson Brown, Jackson Landers, L-A-N-D-E-R-S, JacksonLanders.com will point you over to my blog. Or you could Google my name. I'm very easy to find, or to get in touch with anyone who's looking to get in touch with me directly about just with hunting questions or speaking engagement. Can email me at jack.landers@gmail.com.
Okay, and the book that you are on pre-order on Amazon is called, what is it called again?
A Beginner's Guide to Hunting Deer for Food. It's published with Story Publishing. They do they're known for books for country living, and that book is off in the hands of the printers right now, and the book will ship in September, and the book is designed for total beginners. It's everything you need to know to learn what it's basically. It's my class condensed into a book. It covers everything from deer evolution to choosing a weapon, to learning to shoot, to butchering, and then cooking, and those recipes at the end. As I said, it's available for pre-order on Amazon.com right now, or it should be in bookstores in September.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much for participating on our program.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for having me.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, broadcast out of the studios of CFRU 93.3 FM, located in Guelph, Ontario. Thank you for listening, and remember, buy local.
Do you love food? Tune in to Cornucopia, the new show about food and eating.
Every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., Kristen and myself, Lisa, will pick a food and talk about its history, how to grow it, how to cook it, and some fun facts.
You can tune into the show on CFRU 93.3 FM or online at cfru.ca.
If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for the show, send us an email at cornucopia@cfru.ca.
So tune in Wednesdays from 5 to 6 and work up a healthy dinner appetite with Cornucopia.
Rabbit Rescue, an organization responsible for finding homes for domestic rabbits in Ontario, is in urgent need of support. They are assisting in a massive rescue of hundreds of dwarf and lop-eared rabbits from Manitoulin Island and need help from donors, potential foster families, and potential adopters. All rabbits will be spayed or neutered by Rabbit Rescue and medically treated for any pre-existing conditions. Medical bills are expected to run more than $20,000. For information about Rabbit Rescue, to make a donation, or to apply to adopt a rabbit, visit www.rabbitrescue.ca. Call 905-875-4343 or email Haviva Lush at haviva@rabbitrescue.ca. That's HAVIVA at rabbitrescue.ca. Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter all need a new warren to call home.
Action Read Community Literacy Center offers one-on-one tutoring and small group learning in reading, writing, math, and computers for adults aged 18 and over in Guelph. At Action Read, we help you identify what you're good at so you can work towards your goals.